2 Corinthians chapter 8, verses 8 to 15. I say this not as a command, but to prove by the earnestness of others that your love also is genuine. For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that you by his poverty might become rich. And in this matter I give my judgment. This benefits you, who a year ago started not only to do this work, but also to desire to do it. So now finish doing it as well, so that your readiness in desiring it may be matched by your completing it out of what you have. For if the readiness is there, it is acceptable according to what a person has, not according to what he does not have. For I do not mean that others should be eased and you burdened, but that as a matter of fairness, your abundance at the present time should supply their need, so that their abundance may supply your need, that there may be fairness. As it is written, whoever gathered much had nothing left over, and whoever gathered little had no lack.
Thank you, Rich, and let me add my welcome to Kev's. It's great to have you here this morning online with us. Well, if you were here last week, maybe you thought to yourself, what on earth are we doing? A four-week series in giving to others during our worst crisis since World War II? It's madness, isn't it? To think about giving to others when our own livelihoods are under threat, our own finances so uncertain. Is that how you felt last week? Or did you think, how timely, how good? Now more than ever, my poor, persecuted Christian family need me. Yes, my livelihood might be uncertain, but their lives are uncertain. Yes, my finances might evaporate, but their lives might be threatened as famine hits. I suspect, of course, most of us hover between these two attitudes. Why are we talking about this? Or how can I help? Even if we sincerely do want to help at times, isn't it true that as we start to do the sums and see our own needs, that the thought of giving can turn from a joy to a burden very quickly? And our initial fire peters out, just like the Corinthians, perhaps. Did you see verse 10? A year ago, you started to do this work and to desire to do it. So now finish. Did you have that experience during the week? All fired up on Sunday. But by Friday, the fires of generosity petering out. A struggle now to follow through on your good intentions. There are so many burdens right now, aren't there? Giving can seem like one burden too many, can't it? But it shouldn't. It mustn't. And I hope to show you today that it isn't. It isn't a burden. Did you notice that was Paul's concern too? Did you see verse 13? Look with me. Paul writes, "For I do not mean that others should be eased and you burdened, but that as a matter of fairness, your abundance at the present time should supply their need." Do you see what he's saying? You don't have to harm yourselves to help others. Paul's just aiming for fairness. Look, if your brother has less than his basic needs, he has, verse 14, need, and you have more than your basic needs, verse 14 again, you have abundance, then isn't it just fair to even things out. You don't have to impoverish yourself. You just have to aim for parity, for fairness, so that everybody's needs can be met. Share what's spare if you want to be fair. That's our big point today. Again, it's a one-point sermon. We're just gonna unpack different aspects of this one big point. Share what's spare if you want to be fair. You see, Paul knows the Corinthians have needs too. They're human beings as well. They have bills to pay at the baker for their bread. They have leaky roofs to repair, carts that keep breaking down. And as we think about giving to needy Christian family around the globe, we must not feel guilty about meeting our own needs too. We're not being asked to impoverish ourselves in order to make others rich. I mean, we can if we want. Paul didn't stop the Macedonians from doing that last week. Do you remember? They gave out of their extreme poverty. They made themselves even poorer to help the needs of poor brothers and sisters. I guess Paul let them do that because they begged him. I guess Paul let them do that because they considered giving a gracious gift from God to the giver. They wanted to do it. I guess Paul let them do it because as they did it, their joy overflowed and more than compensated them for their financial hardship. But that kind of giving is explicitly not what Paul advises the Corinthians. Verse 13, "For I do not mean that others should be eased and you burdened. It's your abundance that should supply their need." Do you see? It's different. If, after meeting our own needs, we have abundance, that is something spare, then share with those whose needs aren't being met. That's just fair. But you know, the sad thing is, I don't think we've even been strong at this less burdensome generosity, let alone the really sacrificial giving of the Macedonians. And you know, can I just say, it's not just me saying that. This is not just Rob's hobby horse for Euston Church. As I was searching for illustrations on the internet, as I do before a sermon this week, I came across a new course that is being launched by a group of conservative evangelicals. They're from Australia, from North America, from Britain. It's called the Generosity Project. Some of the Brits involved include Vaughan Roberts, director of Proc Trust, that runs the Cornhill training course that we send our trainees on. Or maybe you've heard of John Stevens, who heads up the Fellowship of Independent Evangelical Churches. Is God bringing this weakness to our tribe's attention, perhaps? I hope so. The Generosity Project website, it says this. I wonder if you agree. "Our culture of generosity is weak. We don't talk about it. We aren't excited by it. And there is precious little evidence that we are driven by it. It's a problem we should address. And not just to improve the bottom line of our church budgets. No, generosity is a basic fruit of the godly Christian life, a joyful response to God's gospel grace. If generosity is weak, so is the spiritual heart of God's people." That's a strong statement, isn't it? But it is backed up by these chapters we're studying in 2 Corinthians. Paul is clear that this kind of sharing is something that we should want to do in the light of the gospel that we see in verse 9. Did you notice how either side of verse 9, Paul refuses to command this generosity? Look at the contrast between verses 8 and 10. So verse 8, he says, "I say this not as a command." And then in verse 10, he follows up, "In this matter, I give my advice." It's just advice. Because Paul wants to make sure that giving like this flows from the desire of the Corinthians. Spontaneous, internal, intrinsic motivation inspired by Christ's gift to them. And you know, Christ's gift to them had inspired them. Again, verse 10, we've seen that in the past they did want to give. A year ago, verse 10, you started not only to do this work, but also to desire it. If, verse 9, if Christ being rich became poor, so that we through his poverty might become rich, if I really believe that he did that for me, became a human for me, became a human so that he could suffer and die for me, became a human so that he could suffer the torments of hell in my place on the cross for me, so that I might know forgiveness and peace with God and have a home in paradise. If he did all that for me, then won't I want, at the very least, won't I want to share what's spare? Here's verse 9 in a simple graph that I've knocked out. I'm no mathematician. I don't know what you make of it, though. But here's what Christ did for us. He was rich. He became poor, so that we who were poor might become rich. But the striking thing in this passage is that Paul asks us to aim for something much more limited, our next graph. You see, we're just being asked to become a little less wealthy, still having enough for our needs, sufficiency, so that others might become a little less poor, so that they might have sufficiency too. Now, after seeing how giving is actually a gift to the giver, as we saw last week, it may well be that you want to do much more than that. You know, Christ's grace has certainly inspired very radical acts of self-sacrifice. You might even know that Paul, when in the first seven chapters of this letter, when he gets to summarizing his own gospel preaching ministry, he says this: "We are treated as poor, yet making many rich, as having nothing, yet possessing everything." Can you see the parallel with Christ's sacrifice there? You see, whether it's Paul in his gospel preaching ministry or the Macedonians in their giving ministry, these Christians freely, gladly, sacrificially gave themselves to poverty to enrich others. They wanted to. Presumably because, as far as they were concerned, it only looked like poverty. They saw by faith the riches they had in Christ. They counted it a greater gain to give. Maybe you want to give that way too. I hope some of us do, but at the very least, surely all of us at the very least who have known Christ's rich sacrificial gift to us, surely we at least want to share what's spare, don't we? Again, the Generosity Project. Generosity is a basic fruit of the godly Christian life, a joyful response to God's grace in the gospel. What do you think? Are they right? Sometimes, of course, what stops us giving is something slightly different. It's shame about the small sums we're giving. God can't possibly be pleased with my tenner a month to Open Doors, can he? I mean, it's such a pathetic amount in the face of such massive global needs, right? But don't be confused. God doesn't measure generosity, or greed for that matter, the way that we do. He measures our generosity and greed according to what we do have, not according to what we don't. Did you see verse 12? Verse 12, "For if the readiness is there, it is acceptable according to what a person has, not according to what he does not have." So we think very differently, don't we? We think the businesswoman who gives a million must be more acceptable, more pleasing to God, that is, than the widow who gives her monthly tenner. But God doesn't see it that way. Because you see, if you give 1 million when you have a spare 10 million, that's simply not as acceptable or generous as giving a tenner when all you have is a spare tenner. Don't be held back by measuring generosity and greed by the wrong standard. Giving isn't meant to be a burden. God delights in your sacrifice if it is according to what you have, not according to what you don't have. You don't have to impoverish yourself to enrich others. Just share what's spare if you want to be fair. But which will it be? Generosity or greed? Greed comes so naturally to us, doesn't it? Do you remember the way people stockpiled toilet paper and food just a few weeks ago, clearing the shelves without a thought for their neighbours' needs? Do you remember this woman who's going to come up on the screen now? Dawn Bilborough, the NHS critical care nurse, in tears after a back-breaking shift when she found the shelves of her supermarket empty of the fruit and veg that she desperately needed, all because others had greedily stockpiled. Stockpiled! Despite the repeated calls from government not to stockpile. Stockpiled! Despite the repeated assurances of the supermarket chains that there was enough to go around if people would just take what they needed and no more. Shame on us as a nation for not caring better for each other. And look, I don't want to heap all the shame on us as a nation. There have been amazing examples of care and sacrifice in this crisis, haven't there? We haven't lost all our God-given dignity as humans yet. And yet, if you saw that video of Dawn in tears, didn't it make you question how we can be so selfish? I say we. Did we stockpile? The stats suggest that even some of us, Christians, stockpiled. Despite the calls of our God, not to stockpile, but to be generous, not greedy. Stockpiled, despite the assurances of our God that he will provide for our needs. Of course, it's the case, isn't it, that God's people have been greedily stockpiling from the earliest days of our existence. Did you see verse 15? It comes so naturally to us. Verse 15, it's from the book of Exodus, the second book in the Bible. As it's written, "Whoever gathered much had nothing left over, and whoever gathered little had no lack." You might know the story of Exodus. God frees his people Israel from slavery to Pharaoh in Egypt. And he then sets off with them to a new home, Canaan, a land of plenty, flowing with milk and honey, where everybody would live under God's provision and care. And every Israelite in Canaan was to receive an allotted parcel of land, their inheritance, in perpetuity. Every Israelite would be a landowner. And every person there had their own vine and fig tree to sit under and drink wine and eat figs and enjoy the good life. God's plan was to distribute wealth to all his people in Canaan. I wonder, do you remember Theresa May's slogan? I mean, do you even remember Theresa May? It seems like a lifetime ago now, doesn't it, that she was Prime Minister, just a couple of years, even less. Anyway, do you remember her promise of a country that works for everyone? Well, that's what it should have said until the F dropped off. Well, you know, God actually gave Israel a Canaan that worked for everyone. But interestingly, before they get to Canaan, the people of Israel have to cross the desert that lies between Egypt and Canaan. And in the desert, do you know what God did? He took the opportunity to prepare them for a Canaan that works for everyone. Because a Canaan that works for everyone only works if everyone works for fairness. As the people traveled through the wilderness, God fed them with bread from heaven, manna. And each day, each family was allowed to collect a fair portion according to their number of family members. But some got greedy. Verse 15, they gathered much, which left others able, verse 15, to gather only a little. But interestingly, the greedy stockpilers back then, they never got to enjoy their spare manna. It bred worms and stank overnight. But those who had held back, or perhaps missed out through others' greed, well, God made sure they had no lack. He provided for them miraculously. I wonder what drove this ancient stockpiling. Perhaps the greedy Israelites just didn't trust that tomorrow God would give as he had given today. Maybe they wanted an insurance policy against the manna not showing up tomorrow morning. Sensible planning, we might say. But Moses said, faithlessness. Or perhaps it's even worse than that. Perhaps it's greed, pure and simple. Simple love for self and disregard for neighbour. An ancient story, but with searing relevance for our modern world. Relevance, in fact, for the worries of today. Did you know, I learned this week, that there is enough food in the world to feed everybody. Famine doesn't happen because we lack resources, but through a lack of distribution of those resources. That's what the Emeritus Fellow in Economics at Jesus College, Oxford, Donald Hay, says. So if you disagree, you can take it up with him. But he says that we could eliminate food poverty if we just wanted and worked for fairness. Some of us, perhaps, urgently need to remember that we have a God who has promised to provide. As a loving father provides for his children, making sure there's food on the table for them, he's promised to give us our daily bread, just like he did for Israel in the desert. And even more than that, he's promised to lavish the riches of his kindness upon us in the coming age forever and ever. We'll be rich beyond our wildest dreams. And all this because Christ, being rich, became poor so that we through his poverty might be rich. We shouldn't need a command to do at least what's fair and share what's spare. We should be ashamed to selfishly stockpile. And we should be liberated to share, secure in the knowledge that God is our great provider now. We studied Acts a couple of years ago, and in the early church in Acts, Jewish people, gripped by the gospel, did spontaneously what the law of Moses had been commanding them to do without success for centuries. Let me read to you from Acts 4. There was not a needy person among them, for as many were owners of lands or houses, sold them and brought the proceeds, and it was distributed to each as any had need. Sell your holiday property in Pembrokeshire? Sell your pad with a pool in Portugal? Or your place in the Pyrenees? Just to provide for the poor? Surely that's too radical, isn't it? Well, for the first Christians, it was just natural. Do you know this attitude? It carried on for centuries. In the second century, the church leader Tertullian, I'm not sure I've said that right, he quipped that Christians were known for sharing everything except their wives. Who knew they were so witty in the second century? But then 2 centuries later, around 400 AD, John Chrysostom, Archbishop of Constantinople, he lambasted his congregation for filling their houses with silver, while many of their fellow Christians struggled to put bread on their table. Constantinople. Do you know about Constantinople? It was the capital of the Roman Empire after Rome. At one point in history, it was the capital of the world by a country mile. It had 1 million inhabitants, when the next biggest city only had 50,000. It really was the heart of the world. A place full of the art and architecture and artifice of men, a place dripping with gold. I guess the kind of place where you could start to think, actually, I need silver plates on my table, don't I? Well, that's not how the Archbishop John Chrysostom saw it. You see, Chrysostom, he had spent 2 years of his life a while back living in a cave, often fasting, whilst he committed the whole Bible to memory. Here's a man who knows what need really is and isn't. Well, when John discovered that some of his congregation didn't just have silver plates, but had silver toilets, can you imagine? When John discovered that, he was dumbfounded. That's not luxury. That's insanity, he said. It's demonic, he said. Does that sound over the top to you, demonic? Well, it's hard to argue with his logic. He went on, how can you dishonor a brother made in God's image by refusing to feed him when you honor your excrement by receiving it into a silver dish? Ouch. I wonder, have you seen this work of art? Have you seen this? It's a work of art called America. If you can't work out what it is from the picture, it's a golden toilet. It's made of 18 karat gold bullion. It's worth about 4 million just in the materials alone. They say it would sell for 6 million, but it can't sell for 6 million because gloriously it was stolen from Blenheim Palace where it was on loan. So if you have seen it, by the way, please tell the police, they're looking for it. But this work of art, I guess it's a comment, isn't it, on the ostentatious luxury, or as Chrysostom would put it, the demonic madness of the West. Have we bought into the madness? Perhaps we've done it without even realizing it. You know, it's often the case, isn't it, that our concept of needs expands as our wage packet expands and drifts further and further from the daily bread that Christ taught us to seek in prayer from our Father's hand. Does that daily bread seem a little too little to meet your needs? I wonder, would Chrysostom, if he was at Euston Church, would he give us a good dressing down? Or would Tertullian be able to boast about us that we share everything? Which do you think it is? Do you know, there's no point me telling you what to do or be. I'm not going to do that over these coming weeks. You see, you and I, we each have to work out for ourselves what kind of Christians we want to be. Let me tell you instead about Christ, about who he is, about what he has done. Christ, who, being rich, became poor, so that we, by his poverty, might become rich. Let me tell you about him. And then let me tell you about your poor family, persecuted, shut off from aid distribution like other people are, perhaps, who need a little of your riches now, now more than ever. What do you want to do about that? What do you want?